Welcome back to the Falklands War Podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. This is episode 18. Goose Green had been taken. The men of Tupara had buried their dead, along with the names of the Royal Marine Helicopter Pilot, Lieutenant Richard Nunn, and sappers from 3 Commando. It was 30th of May, and the rusty line of the Canberra headed back into San Carlos water. On board were reinforcements from the 5th Infantry Brigade, including Gurkhas, the Scots, and Welsh Guards. They had been collected from the QE2 liner, which had docked at South Georgia with the Guards and the Gurkhas, from where they were collected by the Canberra. Also on board was the new commander, Major General Jeremy Moore, who was to take over from Brigadier Jeremy Thompson. The command post at San Carlos was the outside lavatory and cloakroom for the Port San Carlos Social Club in better times, and Moore surveyed his new HQ, then headed out to talk to the troops. The 51-year-old commander had a habit when he was listening of standing with folded arms staring into the distance. He was tall and angular and feeling boisterous. He had no idea of the horror that was awaiting him within a few days, largely caused by his own officers' missteps and their arrogance. The lack of Sea King helicopters meant the British forces were back on their transport equipment number ones, their boots. It was 3 Commando Brigade's fate to continue to march across East Falklands towards the chain of hills surrounding Port Stanley. 45 Commando had left San Carlos with 3 Para on the 27th of May and were plodding doggedly over the hills, the marshes and streams towards Douglas Settlement. That night at 10 p.m. they collapsed into sleep after the 13-mile route march across terrain that left 15 men injured with sprained ankles and pulled muscles and even cracked bones. It rained that night, freezing rain, and its commander, Colonel Whitehead, knew it was imperative that they make it to shelter the next day. There is a limit to human endurance, and his men were rapidly reaching it. So they abandoned their heavy Bergen packs and set off in fighting order with their weapons and ammunition. Supporting them were the Volvo tracked vehicles, the BVs, which could cover sodden Falkland peat and mud really well. While they only run 4 or 5 per unit, they carried the heavy weapons and equipment as well as stragglers who collapsed. The Scorpion and Scimitar armoured vehicles also handled the ground well. The men marched at 10 yards apart, and the commanders stretched for more than 3 miles, their canvas webbing shrinking and stiffening in the rain and then the sunshine, straining along the hillsides with automatic weapons and ammunition and grenades loading them down. The Falklands lack the richness of wildlife found on other misty, rainy hillside geographies, except for geese, so there was little to delight as the men made their way north. There were the enchanting streams, and a para tickled a 5-pound sea trout one morning to the delight of his comrades. As they marched along, their NCOs would peer at the maps to indicate their position. Rincon de los Indios and Horse Paddocks, then Halfway Cove, Letterbox Hill. Every hour they took 10 minutes of rest, but dreaded the command to rise and walk once more. Every day the NCOs were forced to push them harder until they wilted, blistered, and exhausted. What was draining these men most was that they had no idea how long this torture would last, and each minute they expected the Argentinians to counterattack. 45 Commando reached the hamlet of Douglas to find the local kelpers welcoming. The enemy had departed the previous day. Whitehead ordered 45 Commando to halt and recover, which was going to take 36 hours. Then, the morning of the 30th of May, they continued once more, but now a farmer had lent the British troops a tractor and a trailer, and there it was, carrying the heavy equipment as they made their way towards Teal Inlet. This was an estuary in the northeast of the East Falklands, and 3 Para had already left this area, having marched here at their famous blistering pace from San Carlos. They had reached Instancia House by the 31st of May, but even 3 Para had its limits, and the men secured the farm buildings here, within sight of the lower slopes of Mount Kent, and there the SAS had been busy clearing and patrolling since early May, particularly Delta Squadron. The Argentinians here were members of 602 Commando Company, who were being used as outposts providing early warning of a British attack, and they were not happy. Their normal job was behind enemy lines, and they wanted to be sent to bother the British, not scout as lookouts for the enemy. That was the job of the infantry, they said. But regular Argentine units were not skilled enough to carry out forward reconnaissance, so the commandos had to do it instead. The Argentines had the worst of the clashes. 2 men were killed and 1 captured at an SAS ambush, and that was at Bluff Cove Peak on the night of the 30th of May. Then a bigger skirmish took place on the 31st, when a party of the 602nd Commando was spotted in a building called Top Marlow House. It had been bypassed by the British during their advance. 19 Royal Marines were choppered in during daylight and attacked the house. 2 Argentinian commanders were killed, 6 were seriously injured. Of the 20 there, only 4 had no injuries, and later the SAS said the men of the 602nd had fought ferociously. Meanwhile, Brigadier Thompson was growing more worried. He knew that Mount Kent was strategically important and wanted it populated by British troops before the Argentinians woke up to its crucial role. Should they send artillery spotters here, the British would be vulnerable to observed artillery fire. On the night of 30th of May, an operation was conducted to fly Marines onto the mountain, but it was white-out conditions, a fierce wind was blowing, and it was snowing. The Sea Kings had to return to San Carlos. Later on the afternoon of the 31st of May, they tried again with leading elements of Kilo Company 42 Commando, along with Lieutenant Nick Vaux and Lieutenant Colonel Michael Rose of the SAS. It was a 40-mile flight across the East Falklands, with the choppers virtually at ground level. Sea Kings were dipping in and out of hills. The sheep and the cattle fled in all directions from the noise. Eventually, the two helicopters set down behind a ridgeline 2 miles below the summit of the mountain and out of sight of the Argentinians on the Stanley side. Less than a mile northwards, they saw tracer rounds carving the sky and here and there big explosions. The Marines took cover, dragging their Bergens and ammunition. Out of the darkness emerged SAS Major Cedric Delves of Delta Squadron, who'd just been involved in the attack on the Argentinian patrol, the 602nd we heard about. The commander established HQ at a bivouac a few hundred yards from where they landed, and Kilo Company, under Captain Peter Babington, headed off to attack the summit of Mount Kent. It was with enormous relief that they found it evacuated. The Chinooks were still flying back and forth, carrying 3 105mm guns and 300 rounds of ammunition, but one pilot then miscalculated his height and hit a lake. The pilot recovered and landed at San Carlos, but the chopper had lost a wheel and a door and needed to be fixed. The men on Mount Kent tried to find shelter from the wind and brewed up hot chocolate or tea on their hexamine cookers and ate rations. The next morning they awoke to ice covering and snow crusting their sleeping bags and equipment. At first light, Vaux and Rose climbed the 2 miles up to the summit to support the others on the ridge, and as they arrived, they looked down onto the distant blur of Moody Brook. That was the Royal Marine base taken on the first day of the war, back in April. Just to let everyone know they were there, Rose ordered a few salvos to be fired on Moody Brook, which they thought was an Argentine base camp. There wasn't enough ammunition for full bombardment, but it was the thought that counted. The Sea Kings began to fly in the rest of 42 Commando to secure the adjoining ridgeline of Mount Challenger, which was also unoccupied. The Argentinians had left equipment and trenches here, and on Mount Kent they had moved off to Stanley once it was clear that the British were attacking settlements like Goose Green. 3 Para now held Mount Estancia and Mount Vernet, northeast of Kent, while the SAS were established on the Morrell Heights to the north of Stanley Harbour. On the 4th of June, 45 Commando marched into view on the rear slopes of Mount Kent, having walked the entire distance from San Carlos. The key fighting elements of 3 Commando Brigade were now positioned on the north axis of the advance against Stanley, and they now had to fight the weather. A gale hit the islands. They were covered in mist and snow and rain. White horses were filling the sea while the trenches were filling with water, which froze overnight. Trenchfoot made a terrifying return, and it was at this point that Major General Jeremy Moore arrived to take over. 5 Infantry Brigade had made it to the islands, and its commander was Brigadier Tony Wilson, and he was itching for action. That is not a good situation when you have not experienced the local battles. It can cause tactical blind spots. The land force now comprised 9,000 men, and Major General Moore had to make a quick decision. Should he use 5 Brigade to support 3 Brigades push on Stanley from the north and west, or open up a new axis of advantage from the south? Some whispered that he was afraid that Brigadier Thompson would win the war before his men could do anything. The clear answer was attack Stanley as soon as possible, use 3 Brigade as the battering ram, while 5 Brigade brought up the rear. But Moore, who was now based on board the HMS Fearless, ordered 5 Brigade forward instead, and said that 3 Brigade's 40 commander under Lieutenant Colonel Malcolm Hunt should remain where they were. This was a slap in the face for Hunt, who'd watched the men of 2 and 3 Para getting busy while his men walked dull patrols around San Carlos. He was supposed to join the final push, but now he was being sidelined. He didn't take that lying down and headed to the Fearless for a showdown with Moore. He told Moore that his men's morale would be damaged. They'd watched 3 Para disappear into the distance and expected movement. He warned that Fire Brigade was not fully ready. They weren't used to working on the Falklands. Moore ignored his comments. He wanted Hunt to remain at San Carlos in case the Argentinians attacked and believed 40 Commander were better prepared to deal with this. It sounded logical, but not to Hunt. The 40 Commander leader had watched the men of Fire Brigade disembark and had seen at least one man collapse in tears. They didn't appear physically strong enough. They were not aware of the dangers they faced. When Hunt returned, his 2IC urged him to resign, but that would be churlish. Hunt swallowed his pride and acted professionally, which is more than can be said for Moore, I'm afraid, whatever the embedded English press would write about this coming Armageddon. Moore and Brigadier Hunt agreed that 2 Para, which had been resting, be placed under Wilson's command, and then his entire brigade could begin to open up a southern axis of advantage towards Stanley via Fitzroy and Bluff Cove. They were on the east coast of the Falklands, and the settlements were around 36 miles east of Goose Green. Wilson and Moore failed to take into account the fact that there were very few helicopters available for any moving about. Thompson's men were strung out at the stage between Teal Inlet and Mount Kent and needed whatever helicopters were available as they focused on the high ground above Stanley. The Gurkhas started to come ashore from the Canberra on the 1st of June 1982 and set off for Goose Green at a lick. Wilson flew by Gazelle chopper to Goose Green to meet the men of 2 Para still under temporary command of Major Chris Keeble. The Paras were rather cool in their reception of the man they thought a little wet behind the ears in Falklands combat. Wilson appalled them further by suggesting that 2 Para should form a screen on the high ground while the newly arrived 5th Brigade marched along the coast to Bluff Cove. They knew how hard it was to march anywhere on this peat-laden land, and Wilson appeared to not have a clue. It was time to check out the lay of the land, so Keeble suggested instead they fly to Swan Inlet House, a few miles from Fitzroy and Bluff Cove, and do a recon. 5 light choppers were assembled for a recce, and a dozen men commanded by Major John Crosland of SAS Bravo Company joined this little expedition. The choppers took off at 2 p.m. and fired a salvo of rockets into the empty hillside at Swan Inlet and assaulted the house to find it unoccupied except for a single Argentinian military jacket. They broke into the house and used the telephone, winding the handle twice, which was the correct signal for Fitzroy. 30 miles up the coast, a teenage girl answered and fetched her father, called Binny, the local manager. "This is the British Army," announced Sergeant Morris, who was with the SAS small recce unit. "Can you speak freely?" "Yes," said Binny. "Are there any Argentinians near you?" "No," said Binny. "They just blew up the bridge to Bluff Cove and left." The recce group flew back to Goose Green, and at 4 p.m. Chris Keeble crammed most of his 2 Para Alpha Company, 78 men, into the cabiner's hold of a Chinook, and they headed off to the high ground above Bluff Cove. A second Chinook took off later, bringing in another 78 men of Bravo Company, also from 2 Para. Wilson and 2 Para had pulled off a bold move, or at least they thought so. Back at San Carlos, Major General Moore was appalled and exasperated. "This was a huge risk. Grossly irresponsible," wrote a member of his HQ in his diary. This move by Wilson was obviously designed to force a strategic decision upon the British command. Many in Fire Brigade were rather bitter about 3 Commando Brigade's allocation of resources. Wilson may have saved his brigade from a long delay on the road to Fitzroy, but little did he know he had doomed more than 50 British soldiers and sailors to die. For the next week, the Royal Navy devoted most of its attention to the problems of Fire Brigade. On the afternoon of 3rd of June, the Welsh Guards began their long march to Goose Green from San Carlos, walking for 12 hours before the whole exercise was abandoned. The Guardsmen were just not ready for this heavy going, and they were too heavily laden, and their snow tracks broke down every few miles. Back they marched over Sussex Mountain to St. Carlos. Three brigades sneered at the news. What a contemptible start, they thought. Remember, they were now on the hills above Stanley and forced to hang around the freezing mountain waiting for Fire Brigade to get its act together. It was now that the fate of so many men was decided. The only other way for these soldiers to get to Fitzroy at speed was by sea, and to a scene of a tragedy that would be the worst loss of life in any single engagement for the British during the entire Falklands War. Sometimes the lack of experience when a senior officer is brimming with optimism turns into a deadly result. This was going to be one such incident. On the 5th of June, the Scots Guards embarked on the assault ship Intrepid and sailed in the dark to a location at Lively Island, some miles offshore. Intrepid launched its men from her internal dock into four landing craft under command of our old friend, Major Ewan Southby Taylor. It was not a good night for any shipping. The weather worsened by the minute, and soon the radar became unserviceable. Even with passive night goggles on, Southby Taylor couldn't judge the course. Then a star shell burst overhead and a salvo of gunfire ripped up the water nearby. A British frigate had opened up on their own men. After urgent lamp signalling, the shelling stopped, but the wind was gusting at 70 knots. "It was the worst night of my life," said Southby Taylor later. And being as tough as nails, that means it must have been beyond torture. After 7 hours of struggle, they made it ashore at Bluff Cove. The guardsmen were exhausted. Most had been as sick as dogs, and now they moved off towards two para positions, where Lieutenant Colonel David Chaunder had taken over from Chris Keeble. Four guardsmen were already out of action, suffering from exposure. There was no one at Bluff Cove. No orders were waiting. There wasn't any food, and two para weren't sharing. They only had 2 days of food for 5 days and were hungry and cold themselves. Chaunder's men withdrew to sharing sheds to dry out, leaving their positions to the newly arrived guardsmen. HMS Intrepid had headed off at 20 knots, making it back to San Carlos before dawn. The Royal Navy had picked up messages that an Exocet missile launcher was based ashore somewhere. They weren't taking chances. Back in England, Margaret Thatcher and her cabinet were ratcheting up the pressure on these soldiers. A staff officer wrote that Mrs. Thatcher is under pressure to get Stanley. Every day that Stanley is not taken is another country lost to world opinion. Thatcher was also worried about losing another ship, so she and her cabinet thought that the men of Fire Brigade should be brought ashore at Teal Inlet on the north side of the mountains and then marched to the southern flank. An officer on the Fearless muttered, "Too many people in England are using two small-scale maps of this island." But the die was cast for Fire Brigade, and the Navy agreed to make one more attempt to complete the offloading of the men from an assault ship. On the evening of the 6th of June, the Welsh Guards were embarked on the Fearless, along with two of her landing craft, or LCUs. They had rendezvous with Intrepid's four landing craft off Fitzroy, commanded by Southby Taylor. Things did not go well. There was poor communication. The weather was bad. Fearless only managed to offload two companies of guardsmen into her own LCUs, and then headed back to San Carlos, still carrying 300 men. The Navy had had enough. That was that when it came to assault ships. From now on, Fire Brigade would have to make do with the smaller 5,700-ton landing ships instead of Fearless and Intrepid. And these smaller ships were crewed by civilians, armed only with Beaufort guns. The landing ship arrived that night with artillery ammunition and food, but loitered about after sunrise. Southby Taylor woke up astonished. Didn't these people know that the Argentinian Air Force was highly motivated and had already sunk six British ships? Admittedly, the Argentinian air raids over the previous days had been haphazard. Two Learjets had been involved in a sortie recently. One was destroyed by a Sea Dart missile from the Exeter. The other turned tail and headed home. What had built up was a complete lack of communication between Fitzroy and Naval Command at San Carlos, as well as Fire Brigade's tactical HQ on the jetty there. Who exactly was tasked with defending the landing craft? No one knew. At 4 a.m. on the 8th of June, Southby Taylor was awoken with a request by a Fire Brigade staff officer to send one of the landing craft back to Goose Green to the south to bring back vehicles and signals equipment. Foxtrot 4 was dispatched along with the commandeered coaster Monsunum, but they were told to return only at night. Agonizingly, its master was going to ignore this order. There was now one LCU and a MexFloat pontoon in the bay at Fitzroy, and these were being used to offload ammunition from HMS Tristram just offshore. At first light, 7 a.m., the men stopped for a second. To their astonishment, a second landing ship rounded the point into the little bay and dropped anchor. Moore, or someone, had ordered the Prince of Wales 3 Company, its mortar platoon and a support echelon of the Welsh Guards to head to Fitzroy aboard the Galahad. Just in case, and at the last minute, they'd ordered 16 field ambulance aboard, almost an afterthought. Galahad's master, early that night, had said they were 4 hours behind schedule and should wait until the next night and then went to bed. 15 minutes later, Moore, or someone, changed the plan and ordered them to sail immediately. No one back at Fitzroy nor Bluff Cove knew about this. Wilson did say later he had heard about the initial plan, but when the Galahad had failed to arrive in the early hours of the morning, he had had the same thoughts as its master, that they wisely decided to delay until the safety of the dark. What is a bit of a mystery is exactly who gave the order to go ahead with this madness. The report isn't clear. It basically exonerates the top brass, but we have to finger point. It was Moore rushing about trying to appear in charge of the initiative, and Wilson, who was dangerously gung-ho. Early the next morning, Southby Taylor was horrified as he saw the LSM boats lying unprotected in the bay and commandeered the half-filled landing craft loaded with ammunition and steered them to the Galahad. Then, with Major Tony Todd of the Royal Corps of Transport, he urged the Welsh guards to put as many of their men ashore as quickly as possible. One Welsh officer complained, "I'm not putting my men in with a mixed load. And anyway, we don't want to be at Fitzroy. We want to be at Bluff Cove." A heated discussion followed. These 5 brigade officers had never seen the Argentinian Air Force in action. They were completely blind to the dangers at this moment. There's no forgiving these men, I'm afraid, despite the British journalists summarizing this war in 1982. Southby Taylor was highly aware of the dangers and went ashore, trying to find someone who'd understand the urgency of the situation. The first guardsman staff officer he met didn't believe the men were still aboard the landing ships. "They've all got off," said this staff officer, who has remained anonymous. The classic miscommunication moment had taken place, and it doomed the men. First, Major Barney Ross Smith, who was CO of 16 Field Ambulance, ordered the landing craft to go alongside the Galahad and move the men of the Welsh Guards to shore. What he didn't know is that his second-in-command, a colonel, who has also remained unnamed, told the guards to wait until his medical equipment was offloaded first. This meant the guards lingered in the ship's canteen. Some were actually watching a video. Others were prepping their equipment or standing at the ship's rail, gazing at the shore like tourists. Then the ramp of one of the LCUs jammed, which meant the men would have to climb into the landing craft down the sides of the ship. It was now 1:10 p.m., the time that many previous Argentinian attacks had sown carnage, and today would be no exception. 4 aircraft streaked in from the south, watched by 2 para down the shore. Some of the Scots guards opened fire, but their officers shouted to stop. It was the Harriers. "Get down," shouted the experienced sailors. Then 2 Mirages and 2 Skyhawks were on them, and their world disintegrated. Corporal Mike Price of the Welsh Guards said later he was hesitating whether or not to go down when he burst into flames. A large consignment of petrol for the Rapier generators was still on board the Galahad. This exploded, causing terrible burns on dozens of the Welsh Guardsmen below deck and those assembling to board the landing craft. Then the white phosphorus mortar bombs exploded as well, and within a minute the entire ship was on fire. Men watched their own skin and flesh fry and melt before their eyes. Everything slowed down. Others ripped off burning clothes, their hair on fire. This was a vision of horror. They staggered to the ship's side as the lifeboats hit the water. Across the bay, on board the Sir Tristram, an engineering officer had just briefed his Chinese civilian staff that an attack was imminent when a bomb hit his ship as well. The men managed to launch their boats heading to the Galahad despite being hit themselves in what was later called an act of heroism. The commanding officer of a helicopter squadron, Hugh Clark, watched in horror and then ordered every chopper into the air, and they began winching the men of the Galahad to safety. Meanwhile, the men of Tu Para on shore rushed to help the survivors as they arrived on the beaches, burned and shocked, while the Galahad burned from end to end. Throughout that afternoon and into the evening, a tragic procession of blackened and dazed troops were brought aboard the assault ships or landed at Fitzroy, then were carried to the main dressing station at Ajax Bay. At the same time, the HMS Plymouth was pulverized by 4 1,000-pound bombs. 10 were dropped. A Sea Cat had hit the leading mirage of the attack, and an Oerlikon gunner got a second. But one of the bombs passed through Plymouth's funnel, and a major fire was reported. It was chaos out there. Plymouth limping to San Carlos on fire. The Harriers trying to cover both the Galahad and San Carlos. They had left overhead to help the Plymouth only minutes before the two Mirages and two Skyhawks had arrived at Fitzroy to bludgeon the Galahad. Things were not finished for the British. Landing craft Foxtrot 4 was sailing from Goose Green to Fitzroy with the vehicles, as you know. Its colour sergeant Johnston had been warned by Southby Taylor not to sail during daylight, but he chose to ignore the order, saying, "I've been shut up once by the Navy when we tried to move at night. I'm not going to risk that again." And so he decided to risk the Argentinian attack instead, which was a fatal mistake. The Argentinians attacked the landing craft with cannon and bombs, scoring a direct hit and killing Sergeant Johnston and 5 of his crew. The survivors used a radio on the Land Rover aboard to call for help. They were sinking. The coaster Monsunan headed to their rescue, and then Foxtrot 4 sank with the important Land Rovers and communication equipment on board. The only positive for the British at this stage was that the Harriers caught one wave of Argentinian aircraft on their way back from Fitzroy and between them shot down 4. But 33 Welsh Guardsmen, 7 men of the Royal Navy, 11 other seamen and soldiers were dead. 51 men all gone because of Fire Brigade Commander's hurry for personal recognition. These men were sacrificed by Moore and Wilson, classic old-school British officers who seemed to have not the first clue about how well the Argentinians were fighting. They'd bought into the myth that these Latin Americans were unable to fight or fly, and now their men had paid for their arrogance with their lives. The guardsmen were sent back to San Carlos to recover from their shock and to bring the Welsh in particular back to their full strength. The Navy refused to take responsibility for the attack, saying that Fire Brigade leadership had caused this catastrophe. "We were accustomed to working with the Royal Marines, who understood the imperatives of amphibious warfare," said one. As you'll hear next episode, the debacle at Fitzroy was a disaster for Thatcher's war cabinet. And then Moore, in some kind of hysterical outburst, had signalled that he lost 900 men, which actually confused the Argentinians in a warped bit of reverse propaganda. Buenos Aires then believed they'd scored a major victory with the Galahad and Plymouth. They hadn't, but their pilots had performed exceptionally. We'll pick up the pieces of this terrible moment and its after effect next episode, as this war continued through the second week of June 1982. The music for this series is a composition by Kevin MacLeod called Devastation and Revenge. Please rate the podcast on iTunes if you can. It helps increase the visibility. If you'd like to contact me, you can email me through the website abwarpodcast.com or direct message me on Twitter. My handle is @DesLatham. Until next, goodbye.